welcome to the reading of The Courier on Tuesday, September 20th. And I am your reader, Pete Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind. Republican senators push Hunter Biden probe. Texas Cornyn, 32 others, demand steps to avert meddling. In Washington, Senator John Cornyn of Texas and 32 other Senate Republicans demanded special counsel powers for the prosecutor investigating Hunter Biden, warning Attorney General Merrick Garland to take steps needed to avert political meddling on behalf of the president's son. There's no way of knowing the entire scope of the investigation, but evidence seems to be mounting that Hunter Biden committed numerous federal crimes, including, but not limited to, tax fraud, money laundering, and foreign lobbying violations, the senators wrote in a letter released Monday by Cornyn's office. Fox News, CNN, and other major news outlets reported 2 months ago that the federal investigation into Hunter Biden's business activities was at or near a critical juncture, with prosecutors weighing the possibility of charges. The probe began during the Obama era as a tax inquiry and widened in 2018 during the Trump administration. The inquiry is led by the U.S. Senate attorney in Delaware, David Weiss, a Trump appointee, one of the few kept on by Biden in part to avoid any appearance of political meddling. Marshall, who was the U.S. Senate Department's protocol chief for a period during Barack Obama's administration, they also are aware that they are representing their country. The protocol office is a key player in U.S. foreign policy and diplomatic affairs, working to make sure that U.S. officials don't say or do anything that will offend a foreign visitor or host. The president and first lady were among some 2,000 people attending the funeral at Westminster Abbey. The couple arrived for the funeral, waiting in the back as a procession moved past, before taking their seats among hundreds of others. They arrived in London late Saturday and paid respects to the Queen on Sunday, viewing her coffin at Westminster Hall, signing condolence books at Lancaster House, and attending a Buckingham Palace reception for funeral guests hosted by King Charles III. But the president's public appearances in London has been limited and controlled, part of the choreography around the elaborate farewell to the only monarch most Britons have ever known. He spoke only for just a few minutes Sunday about the Queen, as he recalled how the woman, he said, reminded him of his mother, kept feeding him crumpets when they had tea together last year at Windsor Castle. When Biden spoke to the BBC, the only outlet broadcasting live as he signed the condolence book, the network kept up a split screen with Sir David Manning, a former British ambassador to the U.S., and did not air Biden's comments live. Most other leaders in town have kept similarly low profiles, appearing only to sign the official book of condolence and silently pay respects at the Queen's coffin at Westminster Hall. A few have given interviews to share memories of Elizabeth, including New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who told the BBC about the advice the Queen gave her on balancing work and motherhood. I remember she just said, "Well, you just get on with it." And that was actually probably the best and most, I think, factual advice I could have. Leaders like Ardern and Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese have battled away questions about whether their countries are likely to become republics, saying now is not the time to discuss it. Both countries have the Queen as their monarch. An exception was Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro, who's running for re-election and delivered an open-air campaign speech on Sunday outside his country's embassy in London. Bolsonaro, who trails former President Luiz Silva in opinion polls, insisted to about 200 supporters that the polls were wrong and that he could avoid entering a runoff on October 2nd. Biden and new UK Prime Minister Liz Truss scrapped a weekend meeting in favor of a more robust sit-down next week during the UN General Assembly, and the White House didn't even announce news of the meeting until after British officials had. One senior U.S. official said that Biden's lower profile was less about protocol and more about the fact that it's not our show, it's the Brits' show. The U.S. has to be sensitive to that, said the official, who was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. Peter Selfridge, another former U.S. official, said Biden is in London to grieve and likely does not care that he has largely been out of the spotlight. Selfridge noted that the president's history of personal loss, including the death of his first wife and infant daughter and later an adult son. As a matter of fact, that's probably the way he wants it, said Selfridge, the U.S. chief of protocol during Obama's second term. Then again, some people wiring don't allow them to avoid making a beeline for the first campaign they see, said Eric Desihall, a crisis management expert. But Desihall said in an email that the good news is that most American presidents understand the humility is called for at certain times. And now let's look at some international news. The final farewell. Long reigning queen mourned by Britain, world, and the world at large. London, the United Kingdom, the world bade farewell to Queen Elizabeth II on Monday with a state funeral that drew presidents and kings and princes and prime ministers in crowds in the streets of London and at Windsor Castle to honor a monarch whose 70-year reign defined an age. In a country known for pomp and pageantry, the first state funeral since Winston Churchill in 1965 was filled with spectacle. Before the service, a bell tolled 96 times, once a minute for each year of Elizabeth's life. Then 142 Royal Navy sailors used ropes to draw the gun carriage carrying her flag-draped coffin to Westminster Abbey, where pallbearers bore it inside, and about 2,000 people, ranging from world leaders to healthcare workers, gathered to mourn. The trappings of state and monarchy abounded. The coffin was draped with the royal standard, and atop it sat the imperial state crown, sparkling with almost 3,000 diamonds, and the sovereign's orb and scepter. The coffin was followed into the church by generations of Elizabeth's descendants, including King Charles III, heir to the throne, Prince William, and 9-year-old George, who was second in line. On a wreath atop the coffin, a handwritten note read, in loving and devoted memory, and was signed Charles R. for Rex, or King. Here, where Queen Elizabeth was married and crowned, we gather from across the nation, from the Commonwealth, and from the nations of the world to mourn our loss, to remember her long life of selfless service, and in sure confidence to commit her to the mercy of God our Maker and Redeemer, the Dean of the Medieval Abbey, David Hoyle, told the mourners. The service ended with 2 minutes of silence observed across the United Kingdom, after which the attendees sang the national anthem, now titled God Save the King. The day began early when the doors of Parliament's 900-year-old Westminster Hall was closed to mourners after hundreds of thousands filed in front of her coffin. Monday was declared a public holiday in honor of Elizabeth, who died on the 8th of September, and hundreds of thousands of people descended on central London to witness history. They jammed sidewalks to watch the coffin wend its way through the streets of the capital after the service. As the procession passed Buckingham Palace, the Queen's official residence in the city, staff stood aside, some bowing and curtsying. Mark Elliott, age 53, who traveled from the Lake District in northern England with his wife and 2 children to watch the procession, got up at 1:30 a.m. to stake out a good viewing location near the palace. I know we don't know the Queen, but she's been our head of state for 70 years. You feel as though you know her. You feel as though she's part of the family. It's kind of moving, he said. Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, said in his sermon at Westminster Abbey that few leaders receive the outpouring of love as we have seen here for the Queen. More people lined the route. The hearse took from the capital to Windsor Castle, and many tossed flowers at the cortege as it passed. Millions more tuned into the funeral live, and crowds flocked to parks and public spaces around the UK to watch it on screens. As the coffin arrived at the castle, there were poignant reminders of her love of animals. A groom stood at the roadside with one of her ponies, Emma, and another member of staff held the leashes of two of her beloved corgis, Sandy and Muick. During the committal ceremony in St. George's Chapel on the castle grounds, Dean of Windsor David Connor praised Elizabeth for her life of unstinting service to the nation, but also her kindness, concern, and reassuring care for her family and friends and neighbors. Then the crown and the orb and scepter were removed from atop the coffin and placed on the altar, separating them from the queen for the last time. Her coffin was lowered into royal vault through an opening in the chapel's floor. Charles looked weary and emotional as mourners sang the national anthem. The queen will be laid to rest later with her husband, Prince Philip, at a private family service. The mourners at Westminster Abbey included U.S. President Joe Biden, French President Emmanuel Macron, all of the living former British prime ministers, and European royalty. In Japan, where Emperor Naruhito also attended, several people sipped beer and watched the service at the Aldgate British pub in Tokyo's fashion district. The queen had an especially long history in a country that boasts a long history, and so she deserves deep respect, said dentist Tomika Hazuka. The global outpouring of sympathy touched the king, who on the eve of the funeral issued a message of thanks to people in the UK and around the world, saying he and his wife Camilla, the queen consort, were welcomed beyond measure by the large numbers of people who turned out to pay their respects. Jilly Fitzgerald, who was in Windsor, said that there was a sense of community among the mourners as they prepared to wait hours to see procession carrying the queen's coffin. It's good to be with all the people who are all feeling the same. It's like a big family because everyone feels that the queen was part of their family, she said. Also in London news, Biden, others avoid the spotlight. President among VP guests who keep focus on mourning monarch. In London, American presidents usually make a splash when they travel abroad, holding the spotlight and quickly becoming the center of attention. Not this time. For U.S. President Joe Biden and other presidents, prime ministers, and dignitaries, there was no red carpet arrivals, no big speeches, no news conferences as they gathered for Monday's state funeral for Queen Elizabeth II. Instead, world leaders used to people's hanging in their every word, checking their egos in the service of honoring the Queen, Britain's longest-serving monarch, who died earlier this month at the age of 96 after 70 years on the throne. They know that they are there to honor the passing honor, the individual said. Capricia Marshall, who was the U.S. State Department's protocol chief for a period during Barack Obama's administration. They also are aware that they're representing their country. The protocol office is a key player in the U.S. foreign policy and diplomatic affairs, working to make sure that U.S. officials don't say or do anything that will offend a foreign visitor or host. The president and first lady were among some 2,000 people attending the funeral at Westminster Abbey. The couple arrived for the funeral, waiting in the back as a procession moved past before taking their seats among hundreds of others. Well, let's see what else is going on here. What about the weather? Oh boy, here we are approaching fall. And the article here is about the coming winter predicted to be snowy and cold. Hunker down. That's the winter weather warning from Sarah Perrault, senior editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, Weather Prognosticators in the 231st edition of America's oldest almanac, are predicting a colder than normal winter in the heartland. So, find your snow boots and gather up the gloves and scarves, heavy sweaters, puffy polar coats, and fleece blankets, and prepare for what just could be some bone-chilling days ahead. If you can't hibernate, go west, Perrault says. This year's predictions divide the country, with the western U.S. expecting a wet and mild winter and shivery and snowy weather in the east and Midwest. Potentially record-breaking cold may be paired with above-average snow totals. The western half of Iowa is predicted to be cold and dry, while the eastern half will be cold and snowy, and the Cedar Valley appears to be on the dividing line. The coldest periods will be in late November, early December, and some of the coldest days in early to mid-January and mid to late February, and you may need to put on snow tires as early as November, Perrault goes on to say. November is expected to have snowy periods and very cold temperatures from the 18th of November to the 22nd, followed by rain and snow showers and a few milder days, followed by some more snow and frigid weather. December doesn't look much different, with snow showers and cold temperatures arriving just in time for Christmas. The old Farmer's Almanac weather predictions are traditionally close to 80% accurate, Perrault says. It's enough to cause the average person to develop a weather phobia, which the 2023 Old Farmer's Almanac also details. Fear the cold? Then you may suffer from chematophobia. Do visions of snow and shoveling cause you to break out in a cold sweat? You likely have chematophobia. People really trust it in the almanac forecast, predictions, and charts. We're basically using the same fundamental formula that our founder, Robert B. Thomas, developed in 1792, Perrault goes on to say. Thomas believed weather was influenced by sunspots, which are magnetic storms on the surface of the sun. Solar science, climatology, weather patterns, meteorology is still the core, but over the years, forecasting has been enhanced with state-of-the-art radar and technology and modern science, she explains. Forecasts emphasize deviations from average or normals based on 30-year statistical averages provided by government meteorological agencies and updated each decade. The predictions for late 2022 and 2023 are based on statistics from 91 through 2020. In the heartland, which includes Iowa, sections of Kansas and Missouri, and small slivers of Wisconsin and Illinois, snowfall is expected to be above average in the east, average or below average in the west. Temperature in January and February will be 8 to 9 degrees below average, respectively, and February is expected to average 2.5 inches of the white stuff, about 1.5 inches above normal. March will come in like a lion with snow showers, chilly temperatures, before turning milder in mid-month, but not before showering eastern Iowa with 1 inch above average precipitation. Perrault also says that the Old Farmer's Almanac boasts a broad readership, anyone from their 20s to their 80s, and we've got an Old Farmer's Almanac for kids. As a tradition, I feel like it's a magical combination of wit, wisdom, optimism, fun, and useful information. The new issue includes such topics as the myth and mystery of mistletoe, Ukrainian Christmas dishes, tips for perfect perennials, best fishing days and times, why birds feather their nests, and 2023 trends. The 2023 Old Farmer's Almanac is now available at local retailers. All right, let's turn now to the Cedar Valley page, part of UNI Dome roof to be replaced. Fabric installed in 1999 has reached end of its life. Cedar Falls. The UNI Dome will be receiving a facelift as part of the roof reaches the end of its life. The $8 million project was approved by the Board of Regents last week during its meeting of the University of Northern Iowa. The UNI Dome is one of the most iconic buildings in the state of Iowa, said Michael Hager, UNI's chief business and financial officer. The most recognizable aspect of the UNI Dome, its roof, needs fabric replaced in the center portion of the hood. In 2019, an independent study of the center fabric roof was done. The assessment revealed the fabric had begun to deteriorate and would need to be replaced by 2024. The fabric has a lifespan of 23 years and was last replaced in 1999. The rest of the roof, made up of a hard metal shell, is expected to last until 2040, and it was constructed in 2010. The inside of the dome will not be exposed as repairs are made. Construction is expected to start in the spring of 2023 and be finished by the fall. Hager said that the majority of the project costs will be covered by donations, but university dollars also will be included, as well as money from the athletic department. Another roof is currently under construction at the Innovation Teaching and Technology Center. The project budget is about $5 million. Work on the roof began earlier this year and is expected to be finished by August. Clay tiles are being replaced with a lighter clay, the roof system to fix leaks. Water infiltration problems on the east exterior wall are also being set to be repaired. The center was built in 1903 and was formerly known as the Women's Gym. It was renovated in 2006. Also discussed at the Regents' meeting was the ongoing renewal of the Applied Engineering Building. The project is estimated to cost just under $45 million and is slated to be finished by 2024. More construction is in the near future for the campus as well. Next year, Wisconsin Street north of West 26th Street is set to be reconstructed. The cost is estimated at $443,000. Projects finished this year include updates to restrooms in Dancer Hall and the modernization of Noran Hall, a three-year project. And what else is going on? Well, let's take a look at Waterloo now. Public Health Director resigns. Egbuane steps down for job with Medicaid Management Company. In Waterloo, Nafisa Egbuane is stepping down from her role as director of the Blackhawks County Public Health Department effective the 21st of October. She'll be moving into a leadership position with Molina Healthcare of Iowa, the department announced Monday in a news release. Molina was recently chosen to be one of the three companies to manage Iowa's $7 billion privatized Medicaid program that provides health care for more than a quarter of the population. The company's contract begins in July 2023. It's been an honor of a lifetime to have led this health department. Together we have achieved much, Ebune reflected in an email shared with her staff. I know this team, and I know that you all will do your very best to continue the work. Your shared values and work ethics will carry this department beyond my tenure. I am so grateful that none of the hard work we accomplished was done by one person. It takes everyone's effort to make a collective impact. Egbuane has led the department since coming to Iowa back in August of 2016 from Texas A&M University, where she worked in education and research. Her tenure included restructuring and rebranding for the department, and she played a key public information role in the county at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. We're very appreciative of all the hard work Dr. Egbuane has done over the past 6 years, said Reverend Mary Robinson, Board of Health Chairwoman, said in a news release. She provided the department with impeccable leadership as it went under reorganization during the pandemic and with other supportive services. She also brought us to new heights when we gained national accreditation. This was historic, Robinson went on to say. And most importantly, she was instrumental in ensuring that all county residents knew about and had access to public health services. We wish her the very best. Egbuane and her family will remain in Iowa and plan to stay active in the community. Department Director Caitlin Emmerich will oversee the department in the transition. Harvest gets underway in much of Iowa. In Des Moines, widespread rainfall across the state resulted in 5.8 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service. Row crop harvest has begun, and other field work included chopping silage, cutting hay, seeding cover crops. Producers were also preparing equipment and bins for harvest. Despite widespread rainfall over the weekend, we anticipate unseasonably warm weather and dry weather will continue through the end of September, setting up ideal conditions as harvest activities ramp up, said Iowa Secretary Agricultural Mike Nagy. As we recognize National Farm Safety and Health Week this week, I want to encourage Iowans to keep safety on the roads and the fields top of mind this harvest season. Topsoil moisture conditions rated 14% of the five-year average. 42% of Iowa's corn crop was mature, 2 days behind last year, but equal to the average. Harvest of the state's corn crop began with 2% complete. Corn conditions was 64% good to excellent. 75% of the soybeans were coloring or beyond, 3 days behind last year. Soybeans dropping leaves were 30%, almost 1 week behind last year, and 3 days behind 5-year averages. Soybean conditions remained 63% good to excellent. 94% of the state's third cutting of alfalfa hay was complete. Pasture conditions rose slightly to 34% good to excellent. Some producers have livestock on dry lots due to lack of water in the pastures. Weather summary: unseasonably warm temperatures held on through the last full week of summer, with positive departures approaching 6 degrees in northwestern Iowa. The statewide average temperature was 67.6% degree, 4.2 degrees above normal. Widespread and beneficial rains fell over southern Iowa, with some severe thunderstorms producing pockets of large hail and high winds. And what else is going on? In Cedar Falls, disagreement stalls plans. Land development off First Street held up by road extension dispute. 27 acres on West First Street will not be developed until an agreement is reached on a north-south road extension the city and property owner believes is critical. Staffers from the city's community development department said last week a developmental procedure agreement is still being ironed out for the property west of Walgreens at 2509 Whitetail Drive, south of West First Drive. Lake Ridge Drive is the point of contention, said Wendell Lupkes, a land surveyor with VJ Engineering, who's working on the project on behalf of the property owner ME Associates, based in Springville, Utah. Lake Ridge Drive intersects with First Street to the north, where the Ridges residential development is located. Both sides need to determine an acceptance way to ensure the extension all the way south to Crescent Drive, where more residential development exists, including Thunder Ridge Apartments, occurs in a timely manner. Lupkes has been willing to immediately commit to the northern portion of the extension and a road connecting it to Whitetail Drive to the east. A year ago, the Planning and Zone Commission gave the property the go-ahead in a 5-3 vote to being rezoned to PC2, Planned Commercial District, minus immediate assurances that Lake Ridge Drive be extended. It never reached the City Council because an agreement wasn't reached. ME Associates will not develop the property and has proposed potential uses for the property. Nothing formal. Instead, it tends to get the rezoning and then sell it. Retail, financial services, medical, dental, professional offices, a convenience store, gas station, drug store, memory care facility, a cleaner, a restaurant, bakery, florist, grocery store, or corporate campus are some possible uses of the land. A developmental procedures agreement describes the timing and phasing of the project and outlines other development details as necessary, states a requirement of the Planned Commercial District in city code. The Planned Commercial District is meant to promote and facilitate imaginative and comprehensively planned commercial developments, which are harmoniously designed to complement the surrounding communities, says City Code. It's meant to encourage high standards of building architecture and site planning to foster commercial development that maximizes pedestrian conveniences. It comes with more requirements than the standard C2 commercial zoning, which is what Lupkes previously requested. The disagreement may prove to be a moot point, says Lupkes. ME Associates received site plan approval from the commission for multifamily units on the neighboring 14 acres to the west that's rezoned Planned Residence District RP. Lupkes pointed to previous ownership changes being one major reason for that project never coming to fruition. But if plans were moved forward, negotiations in the Roan extension could be impacted. He's working with the Army Corps of Engineers to resolve a newer stumbling block, including wetlands, and anticipates a major amendment to the site plan for the residential development being brought to the commission by the end of October. And we are reminding you at this time that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services for the Blind. And I am your reader, Pete Welch. And now let's turn to some obituary news. Patricia Eystone has passed at the age of 69 in Waterloo. A public visitation will be held on Saturday, the 24th of September from 2 to 4 p.m. at Locke on 4th, with a celebration of life at 3 p.m. Memorials may be directed to the family Locke on 4th Street, 1519 West 49th Street in Waterloo. And here is the phone number, 319-233-6138, is assisting the family. Michael Whiteman has passed at the age of 73 of Cedar Falls on the 14th of September at Northcrest Specialty Care in Waterloo, Iowa. Following Michael's wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. Public memorial and military flag ceremony will be held at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 21st of September at Haggerty Weichoff Garup Funeral Services, West Ridgeway location. Pastor Tim Platt will be officiating. Paige Hoop, age 63 of Waterloo, has passed on Sunday on the 18th of September of a PBC of the liver while the patient at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics. The family will greet friends on Wednesday, the 21st of September, 2022, at Locke on 4th Street, 1519 West 4th Street, from 5 to 7 p.m. Memorial service for Paige will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, September, at the funeral home. Memorial contributions should be directed to the family. Online condolences may be directed to www.locke, that's L-O-C-K-E, funeralservices.com. Brandon Fuller, age 85, of Brandon, has passed away on the 16th of September. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, 21st of September, at Wesley United Methodist Church in Vinton, with Reverend Brian Channel officiating. Okay, let's turn to some other news here. Sumner man arrested for making false report. In Sumner, a rural Sumner sex offender has been arrested after allegedly summoning emergency responders to his home without an emergency. According to court records, Jason William Gruenberg admitted that he had an infatuation with emergency vehicles after Fayette County Sheriff deputies answered a lifeline call to his Y Avenue home around 1:30 a.m. on Sunday. It was the second of two calls to the address in less than an hour. Gruenberg, age 35, had reported that he was suicidal and consumed alcohol and took four different types of medication, records state. Upon arrival, he told deputies he wasn't suicidal, but he was intoxicated, records state. Authorities have been called to address 19 times with similar results since May. Deputies arrested him for one count of making a false report to a public safety entity. Gruenberg pleaded guilty to the charge during an initial court appearance and was fined $300 plus costs and surcharge and ordered to complete 25 hours of community service. Gruenberg is on the Iowa Sex Offender Registry for convictions for indecent contact with a child and enticing a minor in 2010 in Marshall County. In 2011, he was arrested after he allegedly photographed children at Westfest in West Union. In other local news, in Waverly, CF man arrested after Bremer County chase. In Waverly, a Cedar Falls man has been arrested after he allegedly almost struck a Bremer County deputy squad's car that was running with lights and sirens. The deputy swerved to avoid impact, and authorities allege 59-year-old Robert Paul Denny then failed to stop for the deputy's vehicle and led officers on a chase on U.S. Highway 63, driving in and out of ditches and hitting highway markers. The incident began around 11:05 p.m. on Sunday when the deputy was dispatched to a report of a northbound vehicle in the southbound lanes in the area of Highway 63 and Iowa Highway 93. Denny Land's Rover Defender took exit 178 and Tunnel West on Iowa Highway 3 before coming to a stop in the 1900 block, according to the Bremer County Sheriff's Office. A breath test indicated a blood alcohol level of 0.254, according to court records. Denny was arrested for operating while intoxicated, eluding, and failure to maintain control. The Bremer County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Bremer County Dispatch, Denver Police Department, and Waverly Police Department. In Waterloo, one arrested for stealing 102-year-old's bank data. One person has been arrested for allegedly using a 102-year-old woman's personal information to obtain a credit card. Authorities allege that Haley Ann Cloutier, age 20, used her own name but submitted the Centurion's banking information to apply for a Quick Star credit card. After receiving the card, Cloutier allegedly used the card to make more than $3,200 in purchases at Waterloo stores in April and May. The victim doesn't know Cloutier, according to court records. The company discovered the deception and canceled the card. Police found store surveillance video showing Cloutier using the card at a business, and on Friday, she was arrested for second-degree theft. And now let's turn the page to nation and world news. This is first the digest news. In Washington, American freed in prisoner swap. An American contractor held hostage in Afghanistan for more than 2 years has been released in exchange for a convicted Taliban drug lord jailed in the United States, the White House said, Monday announcing a rare success in U.S. Taliban talks since the militant group took over and took power a little more than a year ago. Mark Friedrichs, a Navy veteran who spent more than a decade in Afghanistan as a civilian contractor, was abducted in January of 2020 and is believed to have been held since then by the Taliban-linked Haqqani network. He was traded for Bashir Nurzai, a Taliban associate convicted of heroin trafficking conspiracy, who spent 17 years behind bars before his release on Monday. In Detroit, U.S. sees slight drop in traffic fatalities. The number of people killed on U.S. roadways fell slightly from April through June, the first decline in 2 years, as pandemic-era reckless driving appears to be easing. But the government says that the number of deaths remains at a crisis level. Estimates from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration show that 20,175 people died in crashes from January through June, a 0.5% increase over the same period last year. Yet the second quarter decline ended a string of seven straight quarterly increases that began in the summer of 2020 with the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. In other news, in Mexico, a magnitude 7.6 earthquake shook Mexico's central Pacific coast on Monday, killing at least one person and setting off a seismic alarm in the rattled capital on the anniversary of the two earlier devastating earthquakes. Korean Peninsula, a U.S. aircraft carrier, will visit South Korea this week for its first joint training with South Korean warships in 5 years, officials said Monday, in an apparent show of force against increasing Northern Korean nuclear threats. Power sources. A dozen environmental groups are starting legal challenges against the European Union's executives branch in a bid to stop the inclusion of natural gas and nuclear power generation in the bloc's list of sustainable activities. European Union lawmakers in July voted to add natural gas and nuclear to the list, backing a proposal from the European Commission that has been drawing fierce criticism and accusations of greenwashing. Myanmar. Government helicopters attacked a school and village Friday in north-central Myanmar, killing at least 13 people, including seven children, a school administrator and an aid worker said on Monday. The air attack in Tabian Township in Saging region appeared to be the highest death toll since the army seized power in February last year, ousting the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi. Lunar rover. The United Arab Emirates will launch its first lunar rover in November, the mission manager said on Monday. Hamad al-Marzouki told the Nationale, a state-linked newspaper, that the Rashid rover, named for Dubai's ruling family, would be launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida sometime between the 9th of November and November 15th. Well, you might be aware of the hurricane that's been brewing in the Caribbean islands. Hurricane Fiona is slamming Caribbean islands right now, still recovering from Maria. Much of Puerto Rico is without power. In San Juan, Puerto Rico, Hurricane Fiona unleashed more rain on Puerto Rico on Monday, a day after the storm knocked out power and water to most of the island, and National Guard troops rescued hundreds of people who got stranded. The governor warned that it could take days to get the lights back on. The blow from Fiona was made more devastating because Puerto Rico has yet to recover from Hurricane Maria, which killed nearly 3,000 people and destroyed the power grid in 2017. 5 years later, more than 3,000 homes on the island are still covered by blue tarps. The storm stripped pavement from roads, tore off roofs, and sent torrents pouring into homes. It also took out a bridge and flooded two airports. Authorities reported one death from the hurricane, a man swept away by a flooded river in the inland town of Camarillo. Puerto Rico officials said that it was too early to know the full scope of damage. The storm was still expected to dump up to 15 inches of rain in some places as it spun away from U.S. territory that is home to 3.2 million people. One death was associated with the blackout. A 70-year-old man who was burned to death after he tried to fill his generator with gasoline while it was running, officials went on to say. Governor Pedro Pierluisi declined to say how long it would take to fully restore electricity, but he said for more or most customers, it would be a question of days. Up to 22 inches of rain fell in some areas of Puerto Rico, and forecasters said another 4 to 8 inches could fall as the storm moves away, with even more possible in some places. It's important to people to understand that this is not over, said Ernesto Morales, a Weather Service meteorologist in San Juan. The damages that we are seeing are catastrophic, Pierluisi went on to say. And in Waterloo, man arrested for taking items from a theme park. A Parkersburg man has been arrested for taking a drone and other items from Lost Island Theme Park where he had worked. Waterloo police arrested David Michael Evans, age 40, on Saturday on a charge of second-degree theft. Bond was set at $10,000. According to court records, Evans had worked at the theme park at 2600 E. Sholis Road but was terminated on the 19th of August. He allegedly returned to the park and took tools and a drone from a warehouse. The crime was recorded on video, and management had asked him to return the items. He indicated he planned to return the items, but never gave them back, court records state. Woman's Fund distributes $35,000 in grants to projects in Cedar Falls. The Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa's Women Funds has awarded $35,000 in 2022 grant funding to three projects of organizations serving women and girls in Black Hawk County. Here are the organizations receiving the grants, the projects that they will fund, and the amounts that are listed by area of focus. Poverty, homelessness, housing of hope, stability for working moms, $10,250. Tri-Pi, summer food truck project repairs, $5,550. And violence and safety, the center of attention, women's traditional house, $19,250. All right, let's take a look at some of the entertainment here on the What to Watch page. On the Hulu channel, there's a new series, Keegan-Michael Key, Judy Greer, Paul Reiser, Rachel Bloom, and Johnny Knoxville will be starring in this 8-episode comedy from Modern Family co-creator Stephen Levitan about a popular family sitcom from the early 2000s getting a reboot, forcing its dysfunctional cast to deal with their unresolved issues in a fast-changing world. The first 3 episodes dropped today. New episodes are available on Tuesday. The Bachelorette on ABC at 7 p.m. This is the season's finale. The second part of season 19, two-part finale, sees Gabby deciding whether to get engaged to Enrique while Rachel chooses between Avon and Tino. The Voice on NBC at 7 p.m. Coaches Camilla Caballo, John Legend, Blake Shelton, and Gwen Stefani continue their efforts to discover and coach the next singing phenomenon on the second night of season 22, Blind Auditions. And on NBC at 9 p.m., New Amsterdam. This is the season premiere. The popular hospital drama begins its 5th and final season. In the premiere, Bloom, Janet Montgomery, Iggy, Tyler Labine, and Reynolds, Jocko Sims, rally around Max, who is Ryan Eggold, as he deals with the fallout from Helen's, Freema Agyeman, decision. Meanwhile, Bloom gives extra space to Leela, Shiva Kalasivan, but she's in for a surprise. Reynolds and Wilder, Sandra May, Frank, help a young terminal patient realize his dream to star in Bollywood show. And Iggy has a breakthrough with a challenging patient. And how about Catching a Classic? Well, there's plenty of those going on here this week. Starring Joan Collins on TCM, that's the Turner Classic Movie Channel, the following movies will be shown: Dynasty, The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing, and The Opposite Sex. And those will be on TCM beginning at 7 p.m. And very briefly, in some other entertainment, this is regarding movies that you love to watch, The Hangover, and that is going to be at 4 p.m., and that has Bradley Cooper and Ed Helms. Total Recall, Colin Farrell, Kate Beckinsale, and that's on TNT at 5 p.m. Cheating for Your Life, and that's a suspense, and that's Heather McComb and Francisca Zeeburb, and that's on LMN at 7 p.m. Shrek, and that was with Mike Myers and Eddie Murphy on Sci-Fi Channel at 7 p.m. Unstoppable, which has Denzel Washington and Chris Pine, that's on AMC at 7 p.m. Terminator, Dark Fate, starring Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's on TNT at 7:30 p.m. All right, let's take a look today at history. Today's highlight, on the 20th of September, 1973, in the so-called Battle of the Sexes, tennis star Billie Jean King defeated Bobby Riggs in straight sets, 6-4, 6-3, 6-3, at the Houston Astrodome. On this date, 1519, Portuguese explorer Fernand Magellan and his crew set out from Spain on 5 ships to find a western passage to the Spice Islands. Magellan was killed en route, but one of his ships eventually circled the world. In 1881, Chester A. Arthur was sworn in as the 21st president of the U.S., United States, succeeding the assassinated James A. Garfield. In 1946, the first Cannes Film Festival opened in France. In 1962, James Meredith, a black student, was blocked from enrolling at the University of Mississippi by Democratic Governor Ross R. Burnett. Meredith was later admitted. In 1967, the Cunard liner RMS Queen Elizabeth II was christened by Britain Queen Elizabeth II in Clydebank, Scotland. In 1973, singer-songwriter Jim Croce died in a plane crash in Louisiana, and he was 30 at the time. In 1995, a movie that stunned Wall Street, AT&T announced it was splitting into 3 companies. In 2000, independent counsel Robert Ray announced the end of the Whitewater investigation, saying there was insufficient evidence to warrant charges against President and Mrs. Clinton. In 2001, during an address to a joint session of Congress, President Bush announced a new cabinet-level office to fortify Homeland Security and named Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge as its director. In 2011, repeal of the U.S. military 18-year-old Don't Ask, Don't Tell compromise took effect, allowing gay and lesbian service members to serve openly. In 2019, Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, the 1979 site of the nation's worst commercial nuclear power incident, was shut down by its owner after producing electricity for 45 years. 10 years ago, on a day when thousands of angry Pakistanians tried to make their way to the U.S. Embassy in Istanbul, the embassy aired an ad on Pakistan television showing President Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton denouncing an anti-Islamic video produced in the U.S. Space Shutter Endeavor landed at Edwards Air Force Base en route to its eventual retirement home in the California Science Centers in Los Angeles. Let's take a look at some other news briefs right now. Power sources. A dozen environmental groups are starting legal challenges against the European Union's executive branch in a bid to stop the inclusion of natural gas and nuclear power generation in the bloc's list of sustainable activities. European Union lawmakers in July voted to add natural gas and nuclear to the list, backing a proposal from the European Commission that has been drawing fierce criticism and accusations of greenwashing. Migrant flights. A Texas sheriff on Monday opened a criminal investigation into two flights of migrants sent to Martha's Vineyard by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. But Bexar County Sheriff Yavar Salazar did not say what laws may have been broken in putting 48 Venezuelans on private planes last week from San Antonio. Taiwan. About 400 tourists were stranded on a mountain slide when a strong earthquake hit Taiwan, have descended safely as the island on Monday repaired damages caused by the 6.8 magnitude quake, which hit the island on Sunday afternoon. And a major storm that battered western Alaska over the weekend churned through northern California on Monday after bringing early season snow to mountains and dropping rain that helped firefighters increase their containment of the 119 square mile mosquito fire in the Sierra Nevada foothills, northeast of Sacramento. And now let's turn to our last page here for today, and this is on nutrition. And there are a number of things here that you should probably know, four foods you should not keep in your refrigerator, and here is what they are. One of the best ways to eat a healthier diet is to eat more fruits and vegetables. And one of the worst things about buying fresh fruits and vegetables is watching them go bad in your produce drawer and throwing them away. No one wants to throw their food and money in the garbage. One way to help ensure that you're eating your produce is to make a plan. Having a few meals and snacks planned out means that you're more likely to eat up. Another key is to make sure you're storing your fruits and veggies the right way to keep them fresh. The fridge isn't always the answer, and as it turns out, the refrigerator is not the go-to storage unit for all of your produce. Here are four types of produce you should not have in your refrigerator. Number one, tomatoes. If you've ever grown tomatoes, then you know how they love the heat and hate the cold. Turns out even after they've been plucked from the vine, they still hold their aversion to cold. The fridge is not the ideal place to store tomatoes. Store them there, and your perfect tomato turns into a mealy disappointment. They'll still be good for cooking, but not the best for eating fresh. Instead, store them on your counter, not in direct sunlight, and enjoy them when they are ripe. And what else? Potatoes. Potatoes like cool but not cold temperatures. They do best at around 45 degrees, which is about 10 degrees warmer than the average refrigerator. Most of us don't have a root cellar, a cool, dark place to store root vegetables and potatoes, so keeping them in a paper bag in a coolish spot like a pantry is best. And why paper? It's more breathable than plastic, so the potatoes won't succumb to rot as easily. What else? Well, how about fresh herbs is number three in our list. Fresh herbs like basil, parsley, and cilantro don't belong in the fridge. Spending extended periods of time in a cold environment causes them to wilt. Fresh herbs do best when stored on your counter and treated as you would fresh cut flowers. Basil can be stored in a cup of water, change it every day or two, away from direct sunlight. Covering it from direct sunlight will help it in many different ways. Covering it loosely with a plastic bag will also keep it moist, but make sure that the bag has an opening to allow for some fresh air to seep in. And finally on our list, onions. Onions don't come out of the ground with a protective papery skin. To develop and keep that dry outer layer, they need to be cured and then kept in a dry environment like a pantry, which is not as damp as the refrigerator. Also, lack of air circulation will cause onions to spoil, as well as storing them near the potatoes, which gives off moisture and gas that can cause onions to spoil quickly. Store onions in a cool, dry, dark place and make sure it's well ventilated. And that just about does it here for the reading today of the Courier on Tuesday, September 20th. I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you've been listening to IRIS, Iowa Radio Information Services for the Blind and Handicapped. Thank you for listening today. Have a great day. Bye-bye now.